copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Have you ever been asked the question, why do we have only four Gospels in the New Testament and not many of the others? Because everyone knows that the church has suppressed so many of the other Gospels. Now, don't some websites tell us that there are at least 300 other Gospels which were all rejected? Don't we have sort of random choice? Why did the Council of Nicaea under Constantine only choose these four and rejected all the others? Now, you may have encountered a series of questions such as these. How do you start answering them? But the same question is also asked as an accusation outside the church. Read this, for example, from Bart Ehrman. What then of the other books that claim to be written by these apostles, the ones that did not come to form part of the New Testament? For the most part, they were suppressed, forgotten, or destroyed, in one way or another lost, except insofar as they were mentioned by those who opposed them, who quoted them precisely in order to show how wrong they were. And here a narrative is put up of a Christianity that was widely divergent with all sorts of gospels, but then there was one group that actually suppressed the others. Oppression. And in our modern context, the oppressor is always suspect. It is the colonialist, the one who exercises power and does not accept the beautiful diversity that should be there. It is the modern narrative, and it is a very attractive one to people. So, what do we do with the question, why only four Gospels and none of the others? We're going through a series of arguments, three arguments exactly, but let's have a look at some of the alternatives that are actually available. Although, go one step further back. What do we know about dissent in New Testament times, when the apostles were still around? Was everything sort of peaceful? Were all churches quietly following the teaching of the apostles? Or is there already something in the very beginning of the church going on? Take this, Acts 15. Some men came from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. This is a major conflict. There was controversy in the church. Go to the next one, I hope. Here we are. 1 Corinthians. If Christ is proclaimed to be raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? Major conflict at the beginning of the church. Galatians. As we have said before, so we now say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. And there were those people in the churches of Galatia. Major conflict at the beginning of the church. Timothy. Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, who have swerved from the truth, saying that the resurrection has already happened. They are upsetting the faith of some. And we could go on. In John, many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist. And then finally, Thessalonians, we ask you, brothers, not to be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by spirit or spoken word, or a letter seeming to be from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. As a manuscript guy, I really hope that that letter will be found sometime. Because it will demonstrate the truthfulness of the gospel. If we get some of the writings of the opponents of apostolic Christianity. But alas, we don't have any material from any of these opponents of apostolic Christianity from the first century. We get them from the second century and later. But then we are quite some out. And there are 16 of them, more or less, where we have at least a bit of manuscript or sometimes the whole of the Gospel. Gospel of Judas, Philip, and Thomas are the most complete ones, and then there are whole loads of other. And we're going to have a look at some of these. And the nameless ones are just fragments. We don't even know if they are really a gospel or perhaps part of a Sunday school handout or something. Might be anything, but let's call them gospel for the sake of catering to the people who might disagree. Okay, first argument why we only have our four gospels is a very simple one. We do not have reliable alternatives. None of these is textually reliable. And I'll show you the problem. Gospel of Judas. Only manuscript we have of it. The only one. Would you like to make this part of a New Testament? Now, what is the textual basis for it? What do we do with all the gaps? Leave it a little bit blank in the New Testament. Textually, the Gospels don't have a particularly good pedigree. This is the Gospel of Mary, where, the last bit is preserved, but most of it is lost. And then we go to the nameless ones. This is all the text we have from one of the Agathon Gospels. So, textually, none of the alternatives has a sufficiently good kind of textual basis. That's a practical problem, of course, not a theological one. But still, most of the alternative Gospels are absent in their original language. Something like the Gospel of Thomas, we only, or most of it, only in a Coptic translation. We don't have the Greek original, only for a couple of snippets, but that's it. Many of those alternative Gospels are known only from Coptic or Syriac or some other language. So there is a real problem there, not just that the manuscripts are fragmentary, but we don't have them in their original language of writing. And therefore the text of these is highly uncertain. But all this is a practical, not a theological point, but it's important anyway. The second argument is this, and that all of these Gospels are written too late to be counted as eyewitness account. Or as to be counted as a trustworthy record of the teaching of the apostles. Now, for some of these Gospels, we only know them by name, because they are referred to by something else. So we don't have any actual text. But at least it gives you some sort of date. And they all come from the second century or later. You might say, that is your sort of late dating. Well, actually, this list I took from Bart Ehrman's book. This is how he dates them. And he has a bias to date them earlier than I would have, actually. But it's interesting, even on his account, that what we have is all too late to make any claim to originality. Compare this to the dates of the Gospels we have. And again, Bart Ehrman would not disagree with this. Gospel of Matthew, 70s. I would date it earlier, never mind. Gospel of Mark, 60s. Gospel of Luke, 60s or 70s. Gospel of John, any time between the 70s and the 90s. And there is a good case to be made to push all these dates actually earlier. But I thought, now let's err on the side of caution here, just for the sake of the argument. So there is a chasm between what we have for the Gospels, both textually and chronologically, and what we have for any of the non-canonical Gospels. And this chronology matters. When it comes to the reliability of the Gospels, sometimes the Chinese whispers argument is used, the telephone game argument, that the Gospels are the product of generation on generation or whatever, or people whispering something to the next stage, and the message gets garbled by the end of it. Well, if critics want to make that argument for the canonical Gospels, how can they avoid making that argument for all these, which are written so much later? So you have to be logically, hopelessly inconsistent in order to get there. And then the third argument is that the alternative Gospels present us with a different Jesus. I mean, what are the four characteristics of Jesus in the Gospels? First, he is the Messiah as promised by the prophets in the Old Testament. That's a very crucial one. Jesus is the fulfillment of prophecy, and there are plenty of citations in each of the Gospels to help us with that. It's a fundamental feature. Jesus is the fulfillment of prophecy. He clearly lived in first century Palestine. So we get reference to tiny hamlets that have a name. We get references to local flora and fauna. We get weather reports almost. We get all sorts of things where it is really situated in Jerusalem in the first century, or in Galilee in the first century. It is all very much there. And then, theologically, Jesus is presented as the one who will save his people from their sins. And it's, of course, located in real Galilee. How do we get that in the non-canonical Gospels? Let me give you an example. These are the hidden words that the living Jesus spoke. And Didymus, Judas Thomas wrote them down. Hidden words. Okay, something extra. And he said, whoever find the meaning of these words will not taste death. Typical example of the non-canonical Gospels. Many of them will teach salvation by knowledge. Knowledge becomes extremely important to escape salvation. Jesus says the one who seeks should not cease seeking. Yes, until he finds. When he finds, he will be dismayed. And when he's dismayed, he will be astonished and he will be king over the all. And then we get the usual sort of stuff where Jesus is portrayed as the one who did not come to save people from their sins, but to bring knowledge. And knowledge will set you free. There's no repentance. There is no sin from which you need to be released. What you need to be released of is all the earthly stuff. All the earthly stuff that holds you back, kind of ascending to true knowledge. It is that earthly stuff. So you need to get rid of that. So his disciples said in the Gospel of Thomas, when will you appear to us and when will we see you? Jesus says, when you undress yourself without being ashamed and take your clothes and put them under your feet like little children and trample on them, then you will see the Son of the Living One and you will not be afraid. Well, don't want to imagine what the church service would look like. But, of course, the meaning here is that once you get rid of everything that's bodily and the sort of thing, once you are to such an elevated state that none of this matters anymore, then you have ascended to the true state of knowledge, which is wildly differing from Jesus as the Savior of the world. Sometimes this ascends to full-blown Gnosticism. A Gnosticism has that sort of division between dualism, between earthly things and knowledge type of things. But full-blown Gnosticism also has a creator myth in it, where the eternal God creates someone a little bit lower than him, who creates someone else a little bit lower than him, and it goes on for quite a while, till you have someone so low that they can create the dirty physical earth. And that is the sort of Gnostic creation myth. I mean, an eternal God cannot be involved with earthly matter. That is too big a distance. So that's why you get those creator myths. And you'll find one in the Gospel of Judas. But we're going to leave that for a moment. Of course, Judas is the one, I'm wondering, when could he have written his Gospel a little bit? But nevertheless, It's all very interesting. You can read the whole Gospel of Judas on the National Geographic website, who actually sponsored thing, and halfway through it is Judas, who was reflecting something that was exalted. Jesus said to him, "Step away from the others. I shall tell you the mysteries of the kingdom." Secret knowledge. It's possible for you to reach it, but you will grieve a great deal. Someone else will replace you in order that the 12 may again come to completion with their God. And then we go into that whole creation myth, the mystery that Judas had been taught. This is the Gospel of Peter, which is not dualistic, it is not Gnostic, but it still presents a different Jesus. Look at what we have here in the Gospel of Peter. Those soldiers saw this at the tomb. They awakened the centurion and the elders, for they also were to assist at the watch. It's interesting, sort of, it's getting beefed up a little bit. And whilst they were relating what they had seen, they saw again three men come out from the sepulchre, two of them sustaining the other and cross-following them, and the heads of the two reaching to heaven, but that of him who was led of them by the hand surpassing the heavens. This is typically second century imagery. If you go to, for example, Ephesus Museum, you will see that by the end of the 1st, 2nd century, people started to create giant statues of the emperors, etc. 2nd century is the time when everything needs to be big and bigger. And of course, sort of, if you want to write an extra gospel or whatever, Jesus has to be bigger and bigger. And here, no, he surpasses the heavens when he comes out of the tomb. But it is still a different Jesus. So, where does this leave us? Well, the non-canonical Gospels fail on three points. First of all, that text is unreliable and they are too late. Secondly, what was the second point? Okay, they were too late. Thank you, I combined them. And the third point is they do not contain the apostolic teaching we have. The skeptics have a conundrum. They want to maintain that the Gospels are not reliable because they have suffered textual corruption. And they want to maintain that the non-canonical Gospels should be included even though the text is corrupt. Which the Brits invented a beautiful expression for. They want to have their cake and eat it. And that is impossible. Thank you very much.